but there was nothing that required his attention. Maybe he had neglected to do something. He could not think of anything. He completed the task he had been hired to do by Paul Gardner. He helped Mike Grobanski out of a bad situation. He was able to make extra cash without Mason and Baxter coming after him. He provided Patty with much-needed funds. He even spent time with Nina. All in all, he had a positive, productive past few days. These kinds of days did not come very often, but when they did, he tried to take full advantage of them. Most of his days were spent waiting for a client to appear with a job that would cover his monthly expenses. They often did not, but that was the nature of the job. In times of great stress, when bills were piling up and he had gone without a client for months, he would resort to finding work outside his profession. The worst was wearing a giant mattress costume and waving at cars that drove by. The store that hired him was having a mattress sale, and they needed a gimmick to attract customers. He was on his last penny and desperate. He shivered at the thought of doing something like that again. It was embarrassing on all levels. He had gone from being a deputy sheriff to being laughed and honked at by drivers. At first, he did not understand the reason for their derision until he spotted a yellow stain on the back of the costume. It looked like someone had peed on it. Calloway had a suspicion it was the store owner's Rottweiler who had done the deed. He hoped he would not have to do something like that ever again. He still had some money left over from Mike's job. Plus, the $500 Paul had given him would keep him on his feet for some time. However, if the client whose beach house he was staying at decided to return unexpectedly, he would have to find other accommodations fast. What he needed was a permanent solution to his financial problems, not to be reliant on the kindness of his clients. When he could not go back to sleep, he got up and made himself coffee. With a hot cup in his hand, he strolled to the water. The weather was cool and a bit chilly this early in the morning. He shivered and returned to the beach house, where he found a spot on the deck where the sun was beating down strong. He took a sip of coffee and closed his eyes. He would go and sit in his office in case a client showed up. True, he had his telephone number on the front door, but sometimes people were hesitant to speak on the phone. When they arrived at his doorstep, they were desperate, or in some cases, paranoid. They worried their telephone was bugged and that their spouse might be listening in on them. They wanted to speak in person, and if he was not there, they would leave. "Once I'm finished with this cup," he thought, "I'll head straight there." Chapter 58. Holt and Fisher were at a diner across from the strip mall. Holt stuffed eggs, hash browns, and toast down his gullet so fast, his cheeks looked like they were blowing air. "You're disgusting, you know that?" Fisher said. "I can't believe you are married."
"Neither can I, but I've been up all night and I'm starving."
He paused and said,
"Why aren't you eating?"
"Just by watching you, I've lost my appetite."
"You shouldn't have too much coffee on an empty stomach," he said.
She stared down at her cup. It was her fourth since she was awoken by a report of a dead body. She needed the caffeine to keep functioning, or else she would crash. There was also the half-digested bagel the garbage truck driver had thrown up. She could not get the sight out of her head. Fisher took a sip. The medical examiner had taken Pedro's body to the morgue. She would conduct an autopsy and let them know what she found. Fisher doubted the autopsy would contradict what they already knew. The crime scene unit had combed through the hopper, but found no murder weapon. She did not expect they would, unless the killer figured the garbage truck would end up crushing the body and the gun with it. Whoever was behind this was fully aware of their actions. They chose a spot where there would be no CCTV cameras. The alley that led from the front of the strip mall to the back was off to one side, away from the prying eyes of the tenant security. Holt and Fisher had provided a brief statement to the press. They did not take any questions. One, because they were tired from an all-nighter, and two, they found out the press had gotten a whiff of their theory. Fisher said, "You don't seriously believe Gardner could have killed Kyla and Pedro on the same night? It's just not possible."
Didn't your friend Calloway have a case in Fairview where the murder victim was seen entering a hotel, but was never seen leaving, even though her body was later discovered under a bridge? I asked him about it, and even he agreed that was a bizarre one. It seemed impossible, but it happened. Fisher said, "Okay, sure. But what you are essentially saying is that Gardner knew his wife was going to leave the house that night. He also knew exactly how long she would be gone, and that the cameras would be off, which would allow him enough time to kill his daughter and her lover, and also dump the lover's body far away from the house." Holt swallowed slowly, but he said nothing. "There is also something else you forgot," she said.
"And what's that?"
"How did he pull this off while intoxicated? Someone would have reported a drunk on the road in the middle of the night, would they not?" Holt blinked.
"Are you sure you're not working for the defense? That's exactly what you sound like right now."
"I sound like someone who's not trying to fit a square peg in a round hole."
"I never said my theory was without errors. I'm only going based on the facts. Gardner had a fight with his daughter on the day she was murdered. The text messages prove that. She had called Pedro that same day, and both she and Pedro were murdered on the same night. The times of death support this. You don't have to be Einstein to put two and two together."
"I still think we are pinning all our theories on one person."
"So you think there are two killers out there?" Holt asked.
Fisher was about to say something in reply, but then she thought better of it. Holt went back to finishing his breakfast, and she went back to emptying her cup. A man approached them. He was wearing a stained apron.
"Are you the detectives investigating what happened across the road?" he asked.
"We are," Holt replied.
"My name is Josh. I'm the diner's cook," he said.
"Okay, what can we do for you?" Holt said.
"I'm not sure if this is important, but I was at the diner a couple of nights ago."
Holt dropped his fork and said,
"Go on."
"The kitchen stove had stopped working, and I figured I could try to fix it. It took longer than I expected, and by the time I left, it was really late at night. I remember when I was locking up, I saw a car pull out from the back of the strip mall. The only reason it caught my attention was the way the car sped away like it was in a hurry or something. I could hear the squealing of tires."
"What did it look like?" Holt asked.
"It was a black sedan."
"Did you get the license plate number?"
He shook his head.
"It took off fast, and I was too tired to pay much attention to it."
Holt turned to Fisher.
"What car does Gardner drive?"
She knew where he was going with this. "A black Audi," she replied. Holt smiled and turned to Josh.
"Thanks for your help. By the way, the food was excellent."
Chapter 59. Before heading to his office, Calloway decided to check his emails in case a potential client had contacted him. This way he could go straight to the client instead of making a stop at the office and waste time and gas. He turned on his laptop and quickly browsed through the unread messages. Most were spam and went straight to the junk folder. Some were downright bizarre and got deleted. One or two held potential. He jotted the information down. He checked his watch. It was still a bit early. He would contact them later in the morning. He then checked the news online. The breaking news revolved around a body being discovered in a dumpster behind a strip mall. The body was identified as belonging to a Pedro Catano. The name did not mean anything to Calloway. He was about to move on to the next headline when he sat up straight. The reporter stated that Catano and Kyla Gardner knew each other and that their deaths may be linked. The reporter did not mention any names, but Calloway had a feeling she might be referring to Paul. Calloway got up and moved to the bedroom. Right above the bed was an air vent. He pulled out the metal cover and shoved his hand inside. He pulled out a small box. He used to keep the box in his office, but when he fell behind on his rent, he feared his landlady would change the lock on the front door. He started carrying the box with him wherever he went. The box contained DVDs of all the cases he had worked on. He always told his clients he never kept any relevant information on him. The hard drive on his laptop was empty. Anyone who accessed it without his permission would find nothing. He did not want to be held responsible in case anything happened to him or the client's information. He made sure to burn a copy for safekeeping, however. It was more of an insurance policy than anything else. He once gave photos to a client that showed an affair his wife was having. The client wanted him to destroy all the copies that he had. Calloway agreed, but something did not feel right. It turned out the client was planning to murder his wife and blame it on Calloway, as he was seen following her around the previous week. Calloway alerted the authorities before the client was able to take any action. The photos he took proved he had been hired by the client for a surveillance job and nothing else. This was why Calloway had gone straight to Paul after he found out Paul was a murder suspect. Calloway was at the scene on the night of the crime. He did not want Holt or someone else from the Milton PD knocking on his door. He wanted to be proactive rather than reactive. This way, they could not point any fingers in his direction. Even though the authorities could compel him to hand over a client's information, and some did take him to court, the judge always sided with him. The judge wanted the detectives to build their own case and not rely on information from a third party. The underlying reason was that the information provided by the private investigator may not be complete, and the detectives should not make assumptions based on a few photos taken at different times. When it came to a serious offense, such as murder, Calloway took no chances. Judge or no judge, he would make sure nothing ever led back to him. Calloway searched through the box and pulled out a DVD with the name Paul G. written across it in black marker. Chapter 60. On the night I was at the Gardner residence, did I see something that could be crucial now? Calloway thought. This was something he had asked himself the moment he found out Paul had been charged with murdering his daughter. Calloway was not convinced Paul was guilty, but he was not convinced of his innocence either. The evidence against him was stacking up fast. Calloway strongly believed the link between Pedro and Kyla could have only come from Holt. He wanted an airtight case, something the prosecutor could use to get a verdict in the state's favor. Anytime a jury was faced with doubt as to the guilt of the accused, they always ruled against the prosecution. They would rather let a killer go free than let an innocent person rot in prison. Calloway had seen all types of people in his profession, from liars to cheaters to sadists, and Paul did not come across as any of them. He could turn out to be a manipulative sociopath, but Calloway had a feeling he was not. At least, he hoped not. In order to satisfy his own intuition, he wanted to do his due diligence and make sure he had not missed anything. If Paul was guilty, he would pay for his crime. The detectives and the DA's office would make sure of that. But if he was innocent, Calloway wanted to clear his conscience and say that he did everything he could to help him. He stuck the DVD in the laptop and pulled up the photos from that night. The first image was the front of the Gardner residence. Calloway was parked across the street, so he had a clear view. There were no cars parked in the driveway. The lights in the entire house were off. He moved to the second photo. It showed a Lexus parked on the driveway, and Sharon was removing grocery bags from the trunk. The third photo showed Paul getting out of his Audi with a briefcase in his hand. The fourth photo was of the house again. This time, the lights were on, but only on the main floor. The second floor was dark. Kyla's bedroom was on the second floor. He was not sure if it faced the front of the house or the back. He could not be sure if she had gone to sleep or not. The next photo showed Sharon leaving the house in the middle of the night. Calloway was up all night. He had dozed off at one point, but the headlights from Sharon's car had awoken him. He was lucky to snap a photo of her driving away before he tailed her. He clicked on another photo. It showed her parking behind an apartment building. She then got out and disappeared inside the building. A couple of hours later, he snapped her leaving the building with a man. The man escorted her to her car, where they kissed before she drove away. The man left the parking lot a moment later. Calloway snapped a picture of the man's license plate, in case Paul wanted to know who he was. Calloway later found out that the man was Sharon's yoga instructor, Kenny Goldman. Calloway had then driven to the beach house, only to find out the next morning that something terrible had happened at the Gardner residence. Chapter 61. Fisher tossed and turned on the sofa. She was in the break room of the Milton PD. After an all-nighter spent gathering evidence from the scene of Pedro's murder, she decided to close her eyes. She did not want to drive all the way home. She figured she could get some sleep here, although she could have used a shower. Going through the hopper had left a strong odor on her, but she was used to foul smells. As a law enforcement officer, she was often confronted with all kinds of situations. Homeless people who had not bathed in weeks, who needed to be escorted out of a building. Finding an unconscious man in his apartment who had soiled himself after consuming too much alcohol. Examining a dead body that had been discovered after several days. For her, the latter was the worst of all. A dead person's organs stopped working, and the body began to release all forms of liquid. And if decomposition took over, the smell was downright unbearable. To make matters worse, the smell of death lingered with you for a very long time. Fisher changed position on the sofa in order to get more comfortable. It was a futile attempt. The sofa was over 10 years old. The coils had begun to poke out of the fabric, and the sofa had a stale odor. Holt would not be caught dead sleeping on a sofa such as this one. He much preferred his own bed. Fortunately for him, he lived only 20 minutes away from the police department. He easily popped in and out whenever he wanted. Also, he needed to see Nancy. Whenever Fisher would fall asleep, something would stir her up. After a few tries, she finally got up. She checked the time. She had been on the sofa for a couple of hours. Even though her sleep was interrupted, it was enough to get her through the day. She could always go home and catch up later. She headed to the ladies' bathroom. She splashed cold water over her face. Whatever lethargy she was feeling was suddenly washed away. After freshening up, she moved to the kitchen. Someone had left the coffee to brew. The aroma was inviting as she waited for the coffee pot to fill. She poured herself a hot, steaming cup and then walked to her desk in the corner. She was surprised to see Holt seated at his desk. "I thought you'd be in your bed snoozing away."
"I couldn't sleep," he said. "What about you?"
"I couldn't sleep either." She took a sip from her cup. She waited until the caffeine coursed through her body before she said, "What are you looking at?" Holt was staring at a stack of paper. It was stapled together at the top corner. He had a tiny smile on his lips. "What's so funny now?" she asked. "You found actual evidence that Pedro Catano was having an affair with Kyla Gardner?"
"Even better." She stared at him. "The blood found on Paul Gardner's shirt matched the victim's."
"And you were surprised by that?" she said. "I could have told you that just by looking at it."
"No, that's not what I was surprised by. It was something else."
"What?"
"When we arrested Gardner, we took a swab of his saliva. Well, the DNA test came back."
"Okay."
"Paul Gardner is not Kyla Gardner's biological father."
Fisher blinked.
"Excuse me? She's not his daughter."
"Wow. I didn't see that coming."
"And it gets better."
"How?"
"Kyla Gardner was 9 weeks pregnant."
Fisher almost dropped her cup. "She was?"
Holt's smile widened. "She sure was. I have the tests right here to prove it."
Fisher pondered this new development. "Okay, but why are you smiling?"
"It's simple. Kyla wanted to marry Pedro because she was carrying his child. When Gardner found out about it, he went into a rage, and he killed Kyla and then Pedro. He knew if Pedro married Kyla, Pedro would also be in line to get the money. Gardner must have also known Kyla wasn't his biological child. This made getting rid of her all the more easy."
Fisher stared at her cup in silence. Holt said,
"You know what this means, don't you?"
"What?"
"We have the motive we were searching for all along."
Chapter 62. Calloway parked the car across from the apartment building. It looked different in daylight. The exterior was gray and the main doors were white. The last time he was here was at night,
There was hardly anyone he saw. Every once in a while, a car would enter the property and disappear around the back. He figured that was where the tenant parking was. It was an entirely different scenario than before. Several cars were lined up by the apartment's front entrance. They were waiting to drop off or pick up passengers. Even the visitor's parking lot was full. He had driven by the Gardner residence on his way here. There was still yellow police tape across the front door. On the front lawn was a makeshift memorial for Kyla. Someone had stuck a piece of 4x4 on the ground with her photo taped on it. Around it were flowers, cards, even teddy bears that neighbors, friends, and strangers had left behind. He had wanted to go inside the house and see the crime scene for himself. He was not sure what he would find if he did, but curiosity was getting the better of him. He watched as people walked in and out of the apartment's front lobby. "I shouldn't be here wasting my time," he thought. "I should be in my office drumming up more business." Somehow, it felt like his assignment from Paul was incomplete, as if there was still more he had to dig up. But what? Paul's lawyer and the prosecutor had his photos. If there was anything relevant in them, they would have followed up on it by now. Why haven't they, he wondered. Maybe neither of them cared what Sharon was up to that night. They were more focused on Paul and what happened at the Gardner's home. If his wife was being unfaithful, that was a personal matter between a husband and wife, not related to the crime itself. Calloway did not entirely agree with that. Every action had a reaction. What if Sharon had not left her home that night? Would Kyla still be alive? Calloway had to believe the answer was yes. Sharon would have prevented her husband from hurting their daughter? Even if she was under the influence of the sleeping pills and had no idea what was happening in the room next to her, the alarm system would have still been operational. That would have deterred Paul from doing anything rash out of fear that the cameras would capture something. He could disable the security if he wanted to, of course, but that would mean Paul was not intoxicated and had the presence of mind to plan the entire crime. There were so many what-ifs, but none of them changed the fact that a young woman was brutally murdered. He started the car, but instead of driving away, he pulled into the building's visitor parking lot. He found a spot and got out. He walked to the main doors, wondering how he could get into the building. He spotted a girl holding the door for her mom. The mom was pushing a baby stroller. Calloway rushed over and helped the girl with the door. He smiled, and the girl smiled back. He watched as the mother and daughter walked to a waiting car. He went inside and scanned the lobby directory. He did not see a name he recognized. He was about to leave when his eyes caught a stack of mail sitting on a ledge below the directory. He was not sure why, but he reached for it. There were about a dozen envelopes. He flipped through the envelopes, wondering what he was looking for. When he saw the name on one of the envelopes, he stopped. Dr. Richard Lester. Calloway's eyes widened. "So that's why he paid me a visit," he thought. He wanted to buy the photos to spare him embarrassment, not his sister. Because the photos would reveal she used his apartment as a place to meet her lover the night her daughter was murdered. Chapter 63. Paul's hands shook as he wiped his eyes with a tissue. Roth had just broken the news to him. He wanted to do it in person, and so he had a taxi pick him up and bring him to his office. Roth did not want to go through the press waiting outside Paul's mother's house. By now, the news would be spreading like wildfire, and the questions would be unrelenting. When Roth had received the call from Barrows, he did not believe it at first. It was only when she sent him a copy of the lab report of the blood and DNA tests that he was able to confirm it. She did not have to inform him of the lab results. She said she was doing it out of professional courtesy. Roth knew she was not. Barrows wanted him to know that her case was strengthened by the new discoveries. The prosecution might even consider going for the death penalty unless Roth was able to convince his client to plead guilty, which he had no intention of doing. Until now. But there were a few things he wanted to clear up first. "Paul," he said, starting gently. Did you know Kyla was not your daughter?
Paul looked up. His eyes were red.
I had no idea. I swear.
Maybe I should have sensed something was wrong when Sharon wanted to get married the moment she broke the news to me that she was pregnant. I didn't ask a lot of questions. We had only been intimate once. But I didn't care. I was over the moon with excitement. I was going to be a father. And guys like me don't marry girls like Sharon. She was beautiful, confident, and she came from a family with money. I was struggling to pay my bills and my student loans. I remember it being the happiest time of my life. His chin dropped to his chest. I had no idea she only wanted to get married because the baby she was carrying was someone else's. I need to speak to Sharon. I need to speak to my wife right now.
Your ex-wife.
Paul looked at him, confused.
Sharon's filed for divorce. I was going to tell you when the time was right. You already had a lot on your plate.
Paul was silent. He stared at nothing in particular. A few minutes passed before he lifted his head and said,
"Then I need to talk to my ex-wife. I need answers. I'm owed that much, at least."
"She doesn't want to talk to you, Paul. The documents were delivered to my office, not your mother's residence. I think she is hoping to use me as an intermediary, as I am currently your lawyer. I don't specialize in divorce cases, but I'll take care of this for you at no extra charge."
Paul was suddenly offended.
"I can pay you. I have the money."
"No, you don't," Roth said. "The retainer is almost gone. Your business is on the brink of insolvency, and with a divorce on the horizon, a judge may freeze your personal assets until both you and your wife reach a settlement."
"What are you saying?" Paul asked.
"If this case goes to trial, you might not be able to afford me."
Chapter 64. Calloway walked up the metal stairs to his office when he saw Fisher was waiting for him by the front door.
"Okay, what did I do now?" he asked, raising his hands in mock surrender. "Is Holt waiting in a squad car around the corner?"
"Very funny, Lee," she said. "If I came to arrest you, I don't need Holt. I can haul your ass to the station all by myself."
Calloway shrugged. "I can't argue with that. So is this a professional visit or a personal one?"
"A little bit of both."
"Okay."
"I came to tell you that we have enough evidence to seek the death penalty in Paul Gardner's case."
Calloway grimaced. "I bet it was Holt's idea."
"It was, but I can't find any reason to disagree with him."
"Why are you telling me this?"
"I'm telling you because Gardner is your client."
"He used to be my client. He's not anymore. We had this discussion before, remember?"
"So you don't care what happens to him?"
"I don't," he said.
He moved past her and unlocked the door to his office.
"In that case," she said, "sorry to have wasted your time, Lee."
She started to move down the stairs.
Calloway sighed. "Stop," he said. "I do care."
Fisher walked back up.
"I don't know," he said. "But my gut is saying it's all too convenient."
"Convenient?"
"The body in the house, the knife in his car, his prints on the knife, the fight he had with his daughter on the morning of her death. It smells like it was staged."
She raised her eyebrow.
"Staged?" "Yeah, like someone wanted Paul charged for the crime."
"You're beginning to sound like his defense," she said. "You might not have heard this on the news yet, but on top of everything you just said, Kyla was also pregnant, and she's not Gardner's biological child."
"Whoa," Calloway said in disbelief.
"Whoa, indeed." After Fisher let her words sink in, she said, "The case is overwhelming against your client."
"But you don't believe he did it."
Her eyes narrowed. "What makes you say that?"
"Why else would you drive all the way here to tell me?"
She sighed and looked away.
"I don't know about the whole staged angle, but I do know something doesn't feel right about this. Holt's got his man, but I don't feel I do."
"I was there that night," Calloway said.
We all know that. But what you don't know is that I was there long before Paul or even Sharon showed up.
Okay.
When you are following a target, you have to be at a spot early, and you have to be willing to stay late. I watched that house like a hawk. I saw Sharon drive up to the house. She had grocery bags with her, so I assumed she had gone out shopping. I saw Paul pull up into the driveway. He was dressed in a suit, so I assumed he was returning from work.
Where are you going with this? I don't have all day.
But I never saw Kyla come home.
Fisher shrugged.
Were you there all day?
Of course not.
Then how do you know she wasn't home already?
When I arrived at the house, the sun had started to come down. While I waited in my car, I watched as the streetlights were turned on. But you know what's odd? No lights inside the house came on during that time. Only when Sharon showed up and went inside did the house become illuminated.
So what are you saying?
What if Kyla was never at home that night?
How's that possible? She was found by her mother in her bedroom the next morning.
I don't know, but I'm telling you, no one was home when I got to the house.
Chapter 65. A tearful Louise Catano stood outside his apartment building, facing a battery of cameras and a throng of reporters. He was flanked on one side by his wife and two daughters, and on the other by Senator Baron Lester. Senator Lester spoke first.
I never imagined I would have to stop my campaign yet again to speak on another tragedy that has struck my family. The death of Pedro Catano has affected us deeply. Louise has been a loyal employee of ours for years. He was there before I became a senator of this great state. He was even there before I started my private hedge fund, which made me a very successful man. Louise's loss is our loss, and so I will be covering all funeral expenses. I will also set up a trust fund so that Louise's remaining children have the opportunity for a higher education.
Senator Lester moved aside to let Louise speak.
I would like to thank Senator Lester for coming to my home and for telling me how sorry he is about Pedro. I have worked for the Lester family for almost 30 years. When I came to this country, I had no money in my pockets. Mr. Lester gave me a job, and I was able to raise my family. Pedro was...
He suddenly choked up in tears.
Pedro was going to work for the Lester family, too. But now he is gone.
Senator Lester put a hand on Louise's shoulder to comfort him.
I can tell you the Lester family are good people. They care about people like me. But I don't think Mr. Paul Gardner is a good man. I think he hurt Pedro, and I think he hurt his daughter.
Senator Lester quickly took over.
I apologize for Louise's outburst. He is suffering like any father would be under the circumstances.
Senator Lester held up a newspaper.
What's written in here has caused us a great deal of stress. The facts speak for themselves. The evidence against my son-in-law is irrefutable, I'm afraid. That's why I am imploring him to do the right thing, so that we can put this tragedy behind us. I yet again thank the Milton Police Department for the excellent job they have done. I yet again ask the media for some privacy. The Catano family has lost a son. We have lost a daughter. Let us grieve in peace. Thank you.
Chapter 66. Calloway was back at Paul's mother's house. Instead of taking the back route, he decided to go through the front. The press had doubled from the last time he was here. They had not only clogged the street leading up to the house, but had also taken over the house's front lawn. He parked two blocks away. There was no parking any closer, and made his way toward the house. The press came alive the moment they saw him approach. Cameras turned in his direction. Reporters jumped out of their cars and vans. Photographers began snapping photos. He almost wished he had hopped the neighbor's fence, but he knew the chance of not getting seen this time was slim to none.
The press converged around him like a mob, but they did not impede his path. They yelled questions, they took photos, they rolled their cameras. He merely smiled and walked straight up to the house. He rang the doorbell. He could feel the press crowding in behind him. They wanted a photo of Paul Gardner. The front door opened an inch, and Calloway slid inside. Paul was behind the door. Calloway had called before coming. Paul was not in the mood to see anyone, but Calloway was persistent. Paul stood motionless in the dark hall, as if he feared coming out into the light would burn him. Calloway did not blame him. If he were in his place, he too would want to hide from the world. "How are you holding up, Paul?" Calloway asked. Without replying, he moved to the living room. Calloway followed him. Paul stopped at the fireplace and turned to him. He had aged significantly from the last time Calloway had seen him. His shoulders were slumped, his eyes were dead, and his lips were curled in a frown. He looked like a man who was defeated.
"Did you see the news?" he asked.
Calloway knew he was referring to the press conference outside Louise Catano's apartment building. "I did.
It's a charade by Sharon's family to push me further into the corner," Paul said. "They would rather I disappear than affect the family negatively in any way."
"Or affect Senator Lester's campaign for re-election." Paul considered this. He nodded.
"I'm thinking of pleading guilty. Roth has advised me to consider it."
"He has?
He doesn't think I can afford a lengthy trial."
"And can you?"
"No," he said slowly. "Ever since this nightmare started, I haven't gone back to work. I have no idea how much worse things have gotten. You may not know this, but my software company is underwater."
Calloway was aware before he took Paul as a client. He liked to conduct a background check on each client to find out more about them. But he always assumed Paul was good financially because of the Lester family name. He never imagined they would cast him aside like a leper.
"But if you confess to the crime," Calloway said, "you could be looking at a long sentence, even life." "What choice do I have? I don't have the money to fight them."
Paul put his face in his hands.
"What if they are right? What if I did kill my daughter in a fit of drunken rage?"
Chapter 67.
"Did you kill your daughter?" Calloway asked.
"I don't know," Paul said. "I don't remember much from that night."
"What if you had?" Calloway asked.
"It's something I've agonized about over and over in my head."
"She wasn't your biological daughter," Calloway said.
"I loved her and adored her," Paul said firmly.
"I didn't know the truth until now, so why would I hurt the little girl I raised as my own?"
There's that conviction again, Calloway thought. "Before you do anything that could change your life forever, let me look into this," Calloway said.
Paul stared at Calloway.
"You want me to hire you?"
"Yes, I'm much cheaper than a high-priced lawyer."
"I don't have much money left over.
Whatever I had went to retain Roth's services." "Whatever you do have will help in my investigation."
Paul walked over to the window. He did not dare open the drapes. The mob outside would descend on the front porch like a horde, just to snap a photo of him. He said,
"If this is your attempt at squeezing money out of someone who is desperate, then I loathe what you are doing."
"I can squeeze far more money out of cheaters and philanderers. They will pay up on the spot just to make me go away. So this is not about money, but I do need it for out-of-pocket expenses, and I will waive my own fee."
Paul turned to him.
"Why are you doing it if not for the money?"
"I don't know who killed your daughter, but I don't think it's you."
"What makes you so sure?"
"What makes you so sure you did it?"
He was met with silence.
Calloway asked, "Tell me what happened that night."
Paul rubbed his temples.
"It's all foggy. Whenever I try to think about it, I come up blank."
"Okay, then tell me what you do remember."
He took a deep breath.
"I came straight home from work. I wasn't drunk like they wrote in the papers, I'm sure of that."
"How do you know?"
I know, or else I wouldn't have been able to drive home. I did have a drink once I was inside, though, he said. I grabbed a bottle from the liquor cabinet and headed straight for the guest house.
Was your daughter home? Calloway asked.
I'm not sure. She's 20. She doesn't need or want me to watch over her like I did when she was younger.
What about your wife?
She was home. I saw her car parked in the driveway, but I never spoke to her. We've been estranged for some time. Usually, when I get home, she's up in her room. We don't talk. I'll warm up whatever food is in the fridge, or I'll pick up takeout on my way home. I'll have my dinner in the guest house, sitting in front of the TV.
Is that what you did that night?
I'm not sure. I don't think I had any dinner that night.
Okay, then what happened?
He took a deep breath and shook his head. I don't remember. I really don't.
Think hard, Paul. Your freedom depends on it.
He shut his eyes tight. I think I passed out on the sofa. Wait, I remember a noise. I don't know what it was. It was like a hissing noise, like someone was releasing air. But I do remember it tasting sweet.
Calloway was confused. Sweet?
Yeah, I know it sounds weird, he said. Everything about that night was weird.
Calloway rubbed his chin. He said, I want to see everything Roth has on your case. The detective's notes, the lab reports, the autopsy findings, everything. I want to review it.
Okay.
Also, have you had a drug test? Paul was confounded.
Why? I don't do drugs.
Chapter 68. Holt and Fisher were in the DA's office. Barrow said,
I had a lengthy discussion with Evan Roth.
About what? Holt asked.
About the possibility of a plea deal.
Gardner is willing to plead guilty, Holt said,
not the least bit surprised by this.
Not yet, but I get the feeling his defense may go in that direction.
Fisher said, how many years are we looking at?
If he goes in front of a judge and confesses to the crime, then I don't mind asking for life, with a chance of parole after 20.
What did Roth think of that? Fisher asked.
He wants 15 years, with a chance of parole after 8.
Bullshit, Holt howled. No deal.
Calm down, Barrow said, putting her hand up. I haven't agreed to anything.
You shouldn't either, Holt said. And what about Pedro Catano?
What about him? Barrows replied.
We can also charge Gardner with his murder and ask for a double life sentence.
Do you have concrete evidence that Gardner was responsible for Pedro Catano's death?
We have.
Again, Barrows put her hand up.
The evidence linking Gardner to Catano is all circumstantial. The call to Kyla from Pedro on the day of her death, the assertion by Pedro's ex-girlfriend that Kyla and Pedro were romantically involved, the assumption that Kyla was pregnant with Pedro's child, that will not hold up in court. Did you conduct a gun residue test on Gardner when you arrested him?
Holt stared at her.
No, we had no reason to. Kyla Gardner had been stabbed.
Exactly. We don't have any proof that Gardner had pulled the trigger of the gun that killed Pedro. Unless you find the gun with his prints on it, I'm not going to go in front of the judge and ask that additional charges be laid on Mr. Gardner.
Fisher could see Holt was steaming. Holt said,
We have him by the balls. He is cornered and he knows it. He wants to find a way out and we shouldn't give it to him. No deal.
Barrow sighed.
We also have to see what can be gained from this by the DA's office.
Holt shook his head.
Politics.
Without state funding, we don't exist. So we have to see how each case impacts us. We have to ask ourselves what the public benefit in this is.
Holt said,
The public is devouring the story by the mouthful. Each day, something new and sensational shows up. We have a father who murdered his only child. We later find out the child was pregnant and that she was not even his child. You don't get any more sensational than this.
We also have the family of a sitting senator involved.
Holt pointed a finger at Barrows.
I knew it was politics.
Senator Lester has connections, including with the state governor. He wants this to end as soon as possible. I don't blame him. He is up for re-election. He doesn't want his name or his family's name splattered across the headlines much longer.
He's probably afraid of what else might pop up if it goes to trial, Fisher said.
You are probably right, Barrows agreed.
Holt said, Did you see the Louise Catano press conference?
I did.
Then you know Senator Lester also wants us to go after Gardner for Pedro's death.
I'm sure that's what it came across as. But from what I heard from my sources, Senator Lester wants to see a quick end to this mess. The only way for that to happen is for Gardner to confess to the crime. The press conference was a way to pressure him to do just that. If he does, I will work out a deal with Roth.
No deal, Holt said for the umpteenth time.
I have superiors I have to report to, Barrow said. I do what I am asked.
You do what is right, Holt said.
He stormed out. Chapter 69. Outside the DA's office, Fisher said to Holt,
What's bothering you? Ever since we took on this case, you've wanted to nail Gardner even when not all the evidence was there.
I just don't like parents murdering their children, he replied in a low voice.
Fisher now understood. Holt was a devout Catholic. He did not believe in abortion, and he most certainly was against infanticide. Holt and his wife, Nancy, were unable to have children of their own. They decided to adopt, and they were fortunate to bring a child over from Ukraine. The boy was 4, and he was malnourished. They later discovered he had been suffering from years of neglect. They loved the boy like he was their own blood. With a lot of care and attention, they were able to get the boy back to good health. But on the 7th month after the boy's arrival in the United States, he was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer. The doctors were not sure how he got it, but they were certain the birth parents had known and had done nothing about it. Holt was furious. He wanted to sue the birth parents and have them charged for child abuse. But he had more important things to worry about. He had to find a cure for his adopted son. He paid for the best health care money could buy. He and Nancy took the boy to the best specialists they could find. They devoted all their time and energy to help him get better. But before the year was up, the boy died. Holt held him in his arms as life left his tiny body. Holt was devastated and heartbroken. Nancy went into a deep depression she still had not been able to fully come out of. Holt was angry. He did end up suing the adoption agency, but before the case could proceed further, the agency closed its doors, and the people involved disappeared. Holt flew to Ukraine to pursue them, but he had no jurisdiction, and the local police were no help. He tried to find the boy's birth parents, but that was a futile attempt. He felt lonely and lost. It was as if no one cared what happened to the little boy who was his adopted son. You know, Fisher said to him, Kyla was not 4 years old. She was turning 21 in a few months. Holt stared at her. She was old enough to take care of herself.
Maybe she never thought someone who was supposed to protect her would end up harming her, he said.
You have to let it go, she said. We have done our job. We have to let the DA's office do theirs.
Holt's shoulders slumped, and then he nodded. Chapter 70. The place was tucked between a laundromat and a barber shop. The front windows were covered by heavy blinds, and if you went inside, you would see tables, chairs, and a TV in the corner. But if you went up the side stairs to the second floor, you would enter the Safe Injection Clinic for addicts. It was created by a group of concerned medical practitioners who were fed up with the opioid crisis in the city. There were too many deaths due to overdoses. The elected government officials were not willing to make drug addiction a priority, so the practitioners took action. Funds were privately raised, and a makeshift clinic was established. Whenever Calloway dropped by, which was not very often,
He was always shocked to see the people who visited the clinic. Their eyes were vacant, their faces shrunken, their skin a pale gray or yellow. They were in the deep clutches of their addiction. Their lives revolved around when they got their next hit. Nothing else mattered, not even their lives. The clinic provided them with a safe and monitored site to inject themselves with their drug of choice. Critics would argue that the clinic was enabling them to become even more dependent on drugs. The practitioners countered if the addicts were left to take drugs on their own, they would share dirty needles with each other, administer more of the drug than the body could handle, and they would engage in dangerous and illegal activities. By going to the clinic, they did not have to steal, pimp, or do anything else in order to get their next high. Calloway took the stairs up to where he got in line with about half a dozen people, who were lined up in front of an enclosed booth. As they got to the front, they spoke to a woman behind the glass. She then slid a small tray with the desired drug and paraphernalia across the counter. The users then walked over to a smaller booth in the corner and administered the drug under the watchful eye of a medical professional. Calloway spotted him standing in the corner. He smiled as Calloway approached.
"What do I owe the pleasure?"
"I need something tested," Calloway said. After meeting with Paul, Calloway had gone out and purchased a drug kit from the local pharmacy, which he used to take a sample of Paul's blood. His movements had caused a big commotion when the press caught him leaving and returning to the house. He did not care. Calloway held up the vial with the dark red liquid.
"I'll put it with the other samples," the man said.
The clinic sent samples to the lab to see if addicts were making progress. The clinic's aim was to wean the addicts off the drugs by slowly reducing their dosage.
"What name do you want me to use?"
"The same one I use all the time."
"Dieter Peckerwood it is."
Calloway smiled. He had done a few favors for the people at the clinic, so they were willing to reciprocate. He blackmailed a city official who was opposed to the creation of the clinic. Calloway followed this official until he caught him acting boorishly outside a pub. The official agreed to back off if Calloway destroyed the evidence. Calloway agreed to do so, but he still kept a copy in his DVD box in case the official decided to change his mind.
"And what should we be looking for?" the man asked.
"My client doesn't remember anything from the night before. In fact, he pretty much blacked out the entire night."
"Memory loss and loss of consciousness," the man said, taking notes.
"Got it. We'll see if anything was in his system that might have caused this."
Chapter 71. Paul sat in the living room with his head in his hands. If the press was not bad enough, a group of protesters had gathered outside his mother's house. They held signs, they chanted slogans, they were loud, and they would not stop. He had turned off all the lights in the house. He wanted the darkness to envelop him and take him away from here. They called him a child killer when his daughter was a grown woman. They called him a monster, even though he did not remember doing what he was accused of doing. They called him entitled when he had always earned everything he got in his life. His mother was in the kitchen. She had gone to make tea, but he knew she wanted to be as far away from the noise as possible. His mother had warned him to stay away from Sharon and her family. They were not like them. He came from a humble beginning. His grandfather worked at a factory during the Depression, building trains and railway equipment. His father sold insurance door to door and would be away for weeks or months. They were not poor, but they were always struggling. They never had enough of anything. Not enough food, not enough clothing, not enough money. Not even enough happiness. Their situation had made them a miserable lot. Before Paul's 18th birthday, his father jumped in front of a subway train,